Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week. Well, we've all driven by them, we've swerved around them, we've peered over them, walked through them in some cases, piles of debris left by Hurricane Irma. Millions of cubic feet of palm fronds, tree branches, roofing material, carpet, soggy carpet, fences, all of it rests on our swales waiting for crews to pick up and haul away. It's been almost 3 weeks now since Irma, and most of the debris still waits. It's a weight generated by the massive size of the cleanup job, not just in South Florida, but statewide. Government rules in play and supply and demand of labor and equipment. In the Lower Keys, where Irma's damage was the worst, Monroe County is responsible for cleanup in much of the area. David Rice is a Monroe County commissioner.
Everybody is competing with everybody else to get a limited number of trucks and haulers. We are contracted for 200 trucks down here. I think today we have in the low 40s, and our contractor is working hard. They're trying. But you can't hire haulers and trucks.
That's the supply and demand problem. Randy Perkins' company, Ashbritt Environmental, was hired before the storm to clean up debris in the Keys. He's unhappy that after the storm, the State Department of Transportation hired other crews at rates negotiated after Irma when demand was high.
You can't send DOT into Monroe County or any other county of this state when the rates are 3 and 4 times higher than your current contractors are being paid, because they're taking all the equipment. And by nature, that forces us in a position where we can't perform.
This demand for debris crews is statewide. Local governments want to be careful to follow the federal rules so as not to put FEMA reimbursement for their cleanup costs in jeopardy. So how about it? How frustrated are you with the debris piles that still dot your neighborhood? Has your pile been picked up? Are you understanding of the delay here? And what are all the rules and responsibilities of local and county governments to clean this stuff up as we still have 2 months left in this hurricane season? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. You can send us a tweet about your experiences at WLRN as we get underway here on the Florida Roundup. Mark Caputo, reporter for Politico, along with us. Andy Reid, editorial writer for the South Florida Sun Sentinel. And Nancy Dahlberg covers business and technology for the Miami Herald. Nancy is with us from our studios in Doral. Andy, let's start, first of all, with the debris removal process. Where are we in the process? How is South Florida doing in picking up this stuff?
We're not doing very well. It's going too slow, slower than everybody thought it would. Much of that is the supply and demand issue that's been brought up. Communities had plans in place. They thought they had deals and crews ready to go. But when you've got Hurricane Harvey that hits Texas and takes some of that work over there, and you've got a storm that sweeps across the whole state, and puts virtually the whole peninsula in debris cleanup mode. Now these contractors say, well, we don't have the manpower we need.
Is this a plan that failed or a failure to plan?
Probably both. Like I said, a lot of communities had these locked-in rates. They thought they were good to go, but then the subcontractors went to places that were paying more. And that's a failing on these companies to deliver. Sure, if they committed to something, they need to deliver on it. But the reality is that there's a lot of places to clean up all at once, and so that's drawing, you know, these workers away, and there needs to be a more nimble reaction to how to recover from that.
Mark Caputo with Politico, what about the role of local and state government in trying to hold these contractors to their word in contracts if they were signed before Irma?
I don't want to be too fatalistic, but not only are we dealing with the supply and demand problem, we're dealing with a space problem. I mean, we have damage from Key West to Jacksonville and over in Naples, Fort Myers, maybe all the way up to Polk County. So I understand why all of us are frustrated, and I've got debris on my front lawn, so to speak, but I just think that there's almost nothing that can be done until it bleeds out, and some people are going to get fabulously rich from this.
Yeah.
Basically, if you've got a truck and the ability to put stuff in the truck, you can make government money, and as Ashbritt just said, you can make money at 2, 3, 4 times the rate.
But we've seen cases, haven't we, Mark and Andy, of contracts that have been in place prior to the storm that just haven't been fulfilled because those contractors have been able to find higher bids for their services elsewhere with government entities that put the work out to bid after the storm when the demand was high.
Right. Well, you know, I guess this underscores that better contracts need to be written. And then you got cities like the city of Miami. Miami Herald wrote a really good story about this. Like, city of Miami is going out there saying, hey, contractors, come over here. We'll give you extra money. Mm-hmm. Now, when the city of Miami is passing out extra money, that is just like a license to steal.
Yeah. Nancy Dahlberg, what have you seen and heard from readers as well as just around your neighborhood in the community?
The piles are there. Yeah. They're still there. There hasn't been a lot of movement yet.
And what do you think fuels that? Is it what we've talked about here and this lack of ability of government entities to hold contractors' feet to the fire?
I think so, and supply and demand, as they said. Yeah.
Andy, what about the role of the Federal Emergency Management Agency here? Because this is the agency that sits over top of this. The contracts are on the local level, certainly, but the local governments are careful about following the letter of the regulations so as not to put the entire tab on the local county budget or the local municipal budget to get the reimbursement from the feds.
Seems like FEMA could do more to end this bidding war. They could say, here's how much you're going to get reimbursed, period. Here's the per ton or the per cubic yard rate we're willing to reimburse. And if you go beyond that, it's on your local taxpayers. Then communities might make better decisions about whether they're willing to up the price against each other.
Mark, what do you think about that? And Governor Scott and Attorney General Pam Bondi have kind of come out as strong as anything on this and trying to get the contractors to fulfill their duty.
Well, it sounds reasonable, but not only do you have the problem of multiple layers of government, but then you have problems of shadow governments, HOAs. The Orlando Sentinel had an interesting story, I think, yesterday about how FEMA kind of doesn't allow you to clean up in private, you know, homeowners associations. Mm-hmm. So add that to the level of frustration and complexity of this entire problem. Again, sorry to be fatalistic about it, but I think we're just doomed. We live in a place with a lot of trees and hurricanes. This is going to happen, and Irma hit us perfectly.
Hey, doomed, but also Mark Caputo preaching patience. Is that what I'm hearing here?
Well, I don't think we have any other choice. I mean, you know,
not unless you've got a pickup truck, maybe.
Well, hopefully the city of Coral Gables is going to be patient with code enforcement. Now, I haven't taken down the plywood on the front of my house because I'm like, hey, look, if you're going to have all this debris sitting in front of my house and there's another storm, I'm not going to hang up my plywood again. Yeah. Like, that stuff could easily turn into an airborne missile.
Yeah, what about that, Nancy? I mean, you know, we still have 2 months left in this hurricane season. Ought neighborhoods and communities expect this, even the size of the debris, expected to be picked up faster so it doesn't turn into missiles and debris?
Exactly. I mean, there's every day we hear about other storms out there, and they could come here. It's another accident waiting to happen.
So the impact on government budgets finally here, Andy, the reimbursement side remains to be seen, but Miami-Dade County's in a budget cycle. A lot of these governments are in budget cycles right now. October 1st is a traditional start of some fiscal years for some government entities. What could be the impact?
Yeah, this storm's going to be busting some budgets, and the funny thing is the cities and the counties that are pitted against each other, we're all talking about taxpayer money at the end of the day, whether it's federal reimbursement or local reimbursement. They're arguing about spreading it among more taxpayers, but it's still taxpayers who are suffering from all of this confusion.
And have we begun to see concerns voiced on agendas, on budget agendas about this?
Well,
or
it's funny.
Is this rainy day fund?
Well, it's funny. The storm's coming at a time when communities are just now approving their new budgets for the coming year. Everybody's supposed to have a hurricane fund tucked away. We're gonna see how true to form that is. If there's enough tucked away.
And look, back to the city of Miami. I mean, the city of Miami chronically has fiscal problems.
Right.
And all of a sudden, they're out there saying, hey, guys, we've got extra money for you to pick stuff up. I mean, what are they doing?
And where's the money coming from?
Right.
Absolutely. All right, let's talk about services here beyond just the debris cleanup. Irma was the biggest storm to hit Florida in the smartphone age. After electricity, I think our attention probably turned next to our internet and cellular services, maybe even before electricity in some cases. There has been a real lack of useful information about where the service outages are for cell phones and internet and cable service. When's it going to be turned back on and restored? So if you lost internet and or cable during Irma, what'd you do to stay busy for those days, maybe weeks? John from Palm Beach Gardens wrote us that he played board games and read. Unfortunately, my Dungeons & Dragons group plays online, so no dice there for John in Palm Beach Gardens.
A 20-sided die, right?
Yeah. Alex from Fort Lauderdale, I was able to slow down and catch up with family, cooking and sitting and being still. Cindy from Cutler Bay, I was cleaning up and checking on people. I had to pay for extra data on my phone because of no internet or power.
My name is Javier, and I'm from Pembroke Pines. I curled up with a good book and a nice bottle of red wine. my neighbors and I were hanging out, cleaning up the yard, sharing conversations, and enjoying each other's company. It was nice to reconnect like that.
This is Henry. I'm in Boynton Beach. What I did was I caught up on a novel that I did not get a chance to finish. It was Kevin Birmingham's The Most Dangerous Book, The Battle for James Joyce's Ulysses.
This is Willie from Oakland Park. After the hurricane, we didn't have cell or internet until about Thursday. So what me and my girlfriend did was read a lot of ebooks.
Hi, this is Kay Cassidy. My best time was just to do ornaments for Christmas that did not require any electricity at all.
Getting an early start on the winter holidays, as a matter of fact, and catching up on our reading and cooking. So how did you deal with lost internet or other communication services? Let us know here on the Florida Roundup, 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. Now, it's not just about vegging out, of course, on YouTube or television at all. We're talking about public safety in some degree and being able to communicate with folks. And a lot of people just don't have home phones any longer. And if you do, it's probably a service that still relies on the internet. So, Nancy, bring us up to date here. Nancy Dahlberg with the Miami Herald. Are cell internet and cable services back in South Florida?
For the most part, they are, we think. However, we're not really getting information, as you said before, from the providers. They're not regulated by the state. They're not required to. They're not giving the information. I'm also hearing from a lot of consumers, and the complaints are starting to taper off, and I'm starting to hear from dozens this week that got their service back after 2+ weeks out, especially with the internet. So I think things are improving, mm-hmm. but we're not getting good numbers, so we don't really know.
What's behind the lack of disclosure, Nancy? We FPL, and we've talked about it. You've reported on it. Your colleagues have reported on it. Andy Reid and the Sun Sentinel and Mark Caputo and the Politico have all reported on all of the numbers regarding electricity outages. So why the allowed lack of transparency when it comes to these other outage services?
To put it simply, they're not required to give the information, so they're not. And they're not feeling the pressure, I guess, to give the information either. Now, there was a push after Hurricane Sandy because there was so many problems with cellular outages and that after that storm that there was a bigger push within the industry and within the FCC as well to make sure that the cellular providers had a plan for restoration. Mm-hmm. And that did, I think, result in them being able to get up a little faster than they may have before, or certainly in Sandy, because they did feel that pressure and they made some concessions. However, the cellular providers also were not giving us information about where the outages were, what the restoration estimates are, if one provider or another is having more problems. They weren't giving us any kind of information about that.
Talking about telecommunication services before, during, and after Hurricane Irma, 800-743-9576. Your experiences with an internet outage or a cellular phone signal that was weak, 800-743-WLRN. Nancy Dahlberg is along with us from the Miami Herald, Mark Caputo from Politico, and Andy Reid from the Sun Sentinel. Mark, this idea of disclosure in the electricity delivery business, it's essentially a monopoly. There's one company, you sign up for it, they're required to have these kind of outage disclosures. The competition that is present in telecommunications between cell phone, cable, and internet is certainly much more robust, but yet consumers don't have that information of which systems can withstand barely a level one, category one hurricane.
Yeah, welcome to having choice with kind of no choice here. Right. This is kind of, I think, what happens when you just have these mega corporations. Have you ever tried to get your baggage fee knocked off at the airline? Right? I mean, and these are guys who, according to passengers, not according to airlines, charge people thousands of dollars to try to get out of town.
Yeah.
So we just shouldn't be surprised that in modern America, corporations and corporate culture suck, and you're the one who's going to pay for it, either out of your pocket, out of your own peace of mind, or out of your own sanity when you try to find out what's going on, and they just don't tell you.
So, Andy, is there a marketplace voice here, though, that's going to be telling regulators in the state of Florida, for instance, which is a regulatory light touch type of state, that perhaps these kinds of service disclosures ought to be part of the discussion, certainly in this hurricane-prone state?
You would hope so. It seems like the complaints about cell service and wireless service were almost as strong as the complaints about losing power, and lasted longer in a lot of cases.
Yeah.
And you can't make us a mobile society so dependent on our smartphones and cell phones and Wi-Fi, and then take those services away at the times we need them the most. Cell service mobile companies need to be more nimble and respond to these emergencies like power companies are expected to, and we need better ways to hold them accountable when they don't deliver.
Just remember this, is that all of these regulations and rules would more than likely be passed either by the state legislature, and he chuckles for a reason, mm-hmm, right?
Right?
I didn't
right.
even get to my punchline, or Congress.
Yeah.
And in either case, like, you know, the legislature is essentially the wholly owned subsidiary of a variety of corporate interests. Congress is to a degree. The difference is, at least the legislature does something. Mm-hmm. Usually it favors big corporations over the little guy. Congress usually just does nothing.
But Nancy, we've seen, and the wireless companies especially, have touted, the storm technology, temporary technology that they can deploy immediately after a storm to make sure that cell systems remain robust, be it either emergency generators or even putting cell antennas on drones and flying them over areas. Were those deployed after Irma?
Yeah, they were. I know that AT&T sent down 4 or 6 of them to the Florida Keys, for instance, and had some in Miami. I'm talking about the mobile cell sites.
Mm-hmm.
All of the carriers said that they were using backup generators, as well as all of the cable companies. But it wasn't enough for the response needed.
Yeah, and while we've yet again initiated another debate about putting electric distribution wires underground because of this storm, I haven't heard, Andy, correct me if I'm wrong, I haven't heard such a call to put telecommunication lines underground. And
yeah.
When you're looking at those power poles, usually the wires that are lower and closer to the ground, those are usually the telecommunication lines. The ones that are higher up are the electricity lines.
And the best chance at accomplishing any of those measures is grouping the efforts together, bundling utilities when you can. We're paying these companies a lot of money every month, so the argument that they can't afford to make these investments isn't acceptable, and they need to step up.
Is there a similar storm recovery fee, Mark, that the telecoms could potentially put in place like the electric company does?
Not that I'm aware of, and the last thing I'd want to do is go to the legislature and say, hey, give AT&T and Verizon the opportunity to cost recover damages after
yeah.
a storm. Like
yeah.
FPL already does it. I do think they got power up relatively quickly, relative to everything else, but we're going to pay for all of that.
Yeah.
Like, and to Andy's point is investors and the folks who run FPL are pretty rich and make a lot of money, and they don't have a lot of desire to share that by way of undergrounding our lines. If we want to underground lines, we're going to have to pay for it.
Restoration of services after Irma and the cleanup of the debris here on the Florida Roundup. 800-743-9576. Let's begin in North Miami Beach. Luba, you are on the radio. Thanks for holding on. What are your thoughts?
Hi. I was thinking about the debris, all the branches and trees. Maybe the company who sell wood for fireplace can pitch in and just grab it and, you know, dry it out and sell. Or people who have fireplaces maybe can use it.
So the idea of taking all the trees and limbs and trunks maybe in your neighborhood and turning it into firewood. Well, perhaps, I would say. But again, this gets back to that reimbursement question. It's just not anybody with a pickup truck and some strong arms and a strong back that's going to pick up the debris that's going to charge the city that the city is going to get that money back from FEMA. Right, Andy?
Yeah, and I don't think the Florida winter is going to get us burning through all that debris piled up. But I hear what you're saying, that when we can, we should make better use of this stuff, mulching, vegetative debris,
yep.
you know, things like that are possibilities. But it's going to take a huge effort to get this accomplished, more than just what we can pick up ourselves.
All right, Chris, you are online too in Coral Gables. Chris, thanks for holding on. You're on the radio. Your thoughts?
Hi. My thoughts are that the city of Coral Gables did a wonderful job of picking up the debris right after the storm, at least on my street. Unfortunately, they knocked over a fire hydrant in the process, and my entire lot was flooded with a foot of water. But it was an honest mistake. And as far as what I did in terms of not having TV, and that was a big, big loss, because as a person in my 80s, it's my TV is like my roommate. I really listen all the time. But the substitute was that I had a wonderful Red Cross radio that ran on batteries. I had a good supply of batteries, and I listened to WLRN nonstop. So you guys were a godsend.
Oh, thanks, Chris.
I really appreciate it.
Well, we appreciate you as well, and I'm glad you're doing okay, and hopefully the yard's dried out from that fire hydrant breakage.
Yes, it has, and they've replaced the hydrant already. So
yeah, very good. You weren't hurt by Wilma, but it was the cleanup afterward that hurt. In Davie, Dave, you are with us on the radio. Go ahead, Dave. Your thoughts.
Hey, I'm in the trucking business, and some of the information that you gave over the radio is not correct. The problem for the debris is not being picked up is that the big contractors get the contract from FEMA, and they are paying pittance to the subcontractors, and the subcontractors. Let me give you a scenario. They are paying right now, some areas in Coral Springs, $3 a yard. I have a 25-yard truck. I have to follow a little bobcat with a loader. It takes an hour to get loaded and an hour to dump. Mm-hmm. That pays like $75. This, I know hundreds of trucks are refusing to pick it. They don't want to work for it. It pays too cheap.
So
picking up debris should pay by the hour or by the load. They are taking advantage of the small guy.
So you're getting paid by the load, not by the hour, is what you're saying, Dave. And are you contract?
No, they are paying by the yard. Yardage.
Right. And that's and Andy, that's how FEMA pays here. They pay by volume of debris, not by weight of debris.
Yeah, there are a lot of limits on what FEMA will reimburse and how they'll do it, but it's not hard to believe at all that the guys actually picking up the debris aren't getting all the benefits that the companies contracting to do the work are, and that that these guys would go to where they can get more pay is absolutely reasonable and understandable. It's the companies that lock in a certain rate, don't pay their workers enough, and then go back to cities and counties and say, okay, pay us more now because we need more workers that shouldn't be let off the hook.
No, but what I'm saying, right, let's assume you have a 25-yard truck, right, and it takes you an hour to get the load. Now, when you go to a FEMA-authorized dump site, there's somebody sitting on a tower, and you drive up after taking 1 hour to get loaded, and they eyeball your load and tell you, you know what, you only have 15 yards or 20 yards.
Hmm.
So you get it, you're getting burnt on three ends.
Yep.
This should be paid by the load or by the day.
Yeah, Dave, I hear
you. And we don't know how much the big contractors are getting.
I hear you. Sounds like the small ones getting squeezed here, and the federal regulations, as we've said, they're talking about the volume here. But, Dave, we appreciate your thoughts. All right, we've got Mark Caputo with Politico. He's going to stick around with us. Nancy Dahlberg with the Miami Herald. Nancy, thank you for all of your efforts here and helping us understand the telecommunication services after Hurricane Irma. Appreciate it, Nancy. Nice to hear from you again.
Thank you very much.
And Andy Reid with us for this segment, editorial writer for the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Andy, thanks for your thoughts and your input, too.
Thank you.
We got plenty more to come here on the Florida Roundup, the crisis in Puerto Rico, South Florida's role in helping, and the U.S. reportedly warns Americans against visiting Cuba. We'll have that all coming up next as the Roundup continues. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN, and I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week. Puerto Rico and Cuba now on the Roundup. Two separate stories that continue developing as we're live here on this Friday. First, Puerto Rico. Now, the presidential tweet came Thursday night, 8 days after Hurricane Maria ripped through Puerto Rico. It read, FEMA and first responders are doing a great job in Puerto Rico. Massive food and water delivered, docks and electric grid dead. That is what read at Real Donald Trump for that tweet. 2 days earlier, on Tuesday this week, Senator Marco Rubio took to the Senate floor in Washington after he visited the island.
What I saw is over 3.5 million American citizens potentially on the verge of a serious and growing humanitarian crisis.
South Florida politicians have been busy with Puerto Rico. Governor Rick Scott visited Thursday. He has lunch with President Trump and Vice President Mike Pence today in Washington. Miami Beach Mayor Philip Levine and State Representative Robert Asensio traveled there together this week. Here's Representative Asensio.
We need to prepare ourselves for mass transfer of people. Many we spoke to on the ground said they don't want to leave, but how can they stay? Destination of choice, mostly Florida.
Food, medicine, and other supplies are at the port in San Juan, but there's a shortage of drivers and fuel. Roads remain blocked or damaged, stores are closed, and cash is running low on the island. Do you have family or friends in Puerto Rico? What have you heard? How are they doing? How can South Florida help? And will this natural disaster crisis exacerbate the ongoing economic crisis there and potentially change Florida and Florida politics? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Mark Caputo continues with us, reporter for Politico. Patty Mazzei is political writer for a partner of the Miami Herald, back with us on the roundup, as is Tim Padgett, WLRN's America's correspondent. Patty, you spent the hurricane on the island and did real wonderful work. What are the immediate needs that you continue to hear about today?
Well, we are still seeing lines for cash, for fuel, for ice, for water, for food. I believe the main power company in Puerto Rico said today that 5% of the island has power. Mm. So the needs are all of the above. They have not gone away. I mean, I know people try to think that after a few days after a crisis, things are going to get better and that this isn't a crisis anymore. But what we saw while we were there and what we continue to see is that this is going to be a problem for a very long time. It has overwhelmed the government. It has been a slow response for various reasons, you know, including the previous storms, the fact that Puerto Rico is an island, etc., mm-hmm. and that it was decimated financially. And so this is not, I mean, it's slightly better every day, as they say, you know, now there is an ice distribution. There wasn't for
right.
6 days.
Right.
But it's slow.
Mark, you were there on Wednesday. What did you see?
I saw blocks and blocks of gas lines. I saw a government that is probably its own disaster. And so while it's difficult to piece together why there are supplies at the port and they're not getting out, it really seems as if where there's not a lack of political will, there's a lack of political know-how to get this stuff done. It appears that the Commonwealth's government still kind of wants to remain nominally in charge, and I really doubt their competency. And then on the other hand, you've got the Trump administration, which seems to partly be deferring to the Commonwealth's government. So essentially, you have two governments that neither one of which kind of doesn't know what to do, and the other of which kind of doesn't want to do it. And so folks out there are just kind of suffering and getting by. And at a certain point, I was really shocked that no one got shot more often in waiting in these lines. I mean, you're waiting 5 hours for
$10
in gas.
Some of them were guarded by, you know, even I saw ICE agents guarding gas lines because that's what they were doing. They were helping the response by guarding
Immigration
a gas
Customs Enforcement
that's
agents.
That's correct. Not acting in their immigration and customs capacity.
Just simply law enforcement
correct.
Of some kind. Yeah.
The Seminole County Sheriff, for instance, sent 5 deputies down. He then called the Central Florida legislator, I know, Bob Cortez, who's from Puerto Rico, and told him, I need to get them more ammo. So they not only have experienced a crisis and a disaster, and not only is it an ongoing disaster, but it is primed to get so much worse. And the other thing I saw is while there were blocks and blocks of people waiting to get gas, 5-hour lines for $10 worth of gas, you had like 4 bucket trucks setting up electrical lines. And it's just like, oh my God, this
is gonna take
forever.
I'm surprised you saw bucket trucks because in 6 days I saw none anywhere.
I saw them on day 8.
The sheer scale of this disaster, Tim, is coming to bear here as we're in day 9 and day 10 after Hurricane Maria. And it's been a lot of focused attention on San Juan, and for good reasons. What do we know about the conditions outside of San Juan?
Well, that's the key point. It was the comprehensive nature of this disaster that is really causing the biggest headaches right now. I mean, this hurricane tore through the length and breadth of this island. And what that did was create impossible road paralysis from one end of the island to the other. So we have all of these supplies, food, water, gasoline, etc., sitting in the ports because the Coast Guard and units like that did a fairly good job of getting themselves ready even before the storm to put that stuff in place, get the ports open, etc. The problem is getting it into the interior of the island, which can't be done by normal transportation right now because the roads are just impossible. And even if they weren't open, you don't have enough drivers for the trucks because they're all at their homes right now taking care of their disasters. So it's good that we're finally seeing the Trump administration start to militarize the relief effort a little bit more, because now I think maybe we can start A, getting those roads cleared, and B, start getting those supplies into the interior. I would go back 7 years as an analogy to a different disaster, the earthquake in Haiti, where we had the same situation, but then we saw the military use helicopters, the one vehicle that can get into the interior of a country when you have this kind of situation. And I would really like to see the new honcho now, the Army General Jeff Buchanan, mm-hmm. use that approach. I mean, you know, Jayhawks, Seahawks, Blackhawks, whatever kind of choppers to get those kinds of supplies into the interior of the island.
So we have this Army Lieutenant General who's now in command of the military portion of the rescue and relief effort. Patty Mazzei with the Miami Herald, address that in addition to what Tim is talking about and Mark's real kind of concern about the lack of a functioning government there has been foisted upon the U.S. military essentially to take on the role that it has, and has it been reluctant because of anything within the Trump administration or the Trump Pentagon?
Well, the way FEMA usually works is that it waits for a state government to ask for help. Mm-hmm. And that might not be enough here because the island didn't know what it needed for days because it couldn't get to places. So, I mean, as a best example of this that to me was wild was mayors of all these municipalities had to go physically in person to San Juan to get news and then go back home to, you know, report that news, get more news, bring it back, use gas, try to go through impassable roads to do this on a daily basis. And if they left, they had no communication, so they didn't know something happened on their way back.
Right.
I went to one town where they had one functioning radio station. And well, not radio station, I'm sorry, like a walkie-talkie, like a radio, mm-hmm, to mm-hmm. get to the nearest big city and occasionally through to San Juan. And so they were like, well, we really need a satellite phone. So 6 days after the storm, we're going to send someone physically to San Juan mm-hmm. to ask for one. So mm-hmm. this was not a government that was in a position to know what it needed. And so if FEMA is waiting to be asked, you know, that's just going to be an untenable delay. So what people like Senator Rubio had asked for was, let's at least give the military a chance to be in charge of the logistical mm-hmm. delivery of all of this. They're not going to run the government, but at least say this is where things need to go and when, so we can get them out there now.
If there's one entity that knows how to move people and things, it's the U.S. military, certainly. Mark, Patty mentioned Senator Rubio. It was on Tuesday when Senator Rubio took to the Senate floor. What role did he play in any stepped up response that we've seen over the past 48, 72 hours from the administration?
That's a great question. What we do know is that he raised these very real concerns with the White House chief of staff and with Vice President Pence. And one of the things he said on Tuesday to me, and he said, I believe, to Patty and others, is like, look, we need to get the Army Corps of Engineers in there, not only to clear roads, but in some cases to build roads mm-hmm. or to put in new
and
bridges.
And restore the power grid.
Right. And what's surprising is the Puerto Rican government doesn't appear, Puerto Rico's government appears not to have known what it didn't know. And that is a dangerous combination of ignorance.
Let's go to the phones. Gabrielle is in Fort Lauderdale, or is it Gabriel on line two?
Gabriel.
Welcome, Gabriel. Welcome to the Florida Roundup. Go ahead.
Well, thank you. I just had a comment with respect to all this situation. I received all my families down in Puerto Rico, and I received a phone call from my father, and he just explained to me that he was in line from 4 in the morning to 8 o'clock in the morning for gasoline. And at 8 o'clock in the morning, the federal government, the state police, the Puerto Rican police, they all got to the gas station and basically told everybody to go home, that gasoline was for them. Mm. So my comment is that, you know, with all this information that's coming from different sources, you know, Puerto Rican government has to be aware and the federal government has to be aware that they cannot basically govern and enforce their rules by intimidation, especially people that are trying to get gasoline, because there are gasoline stations with gas available, but they're taking control of them. You know, so
I don't
know if you've heard these incidents before.
Not only, this is Mark, sorry to interrupt you, not only have we heard that, but we also heard that there's apparently more gas than is available. And this is according to Bob Cortez, who's a state legislator, Republican state legislator from Puerto Rico, but he's lives in the Orlando area or Altamont Springs. He had told me that there is actually more gas available and the government is preventing the opening of more gas stations. Now, unfortunately, we're communicating by innuendo here.
Is that because of security concerns?
It might be because of security concerns, but at a certain point, you're going to have to let people be people.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but, you know, when you're saying that ICE agents are there, you know, with security, providing security for this gas station, it might be the other way around. They're just hogging up the gas stations in order to, for the either the federal government or to prevent, you know, whatever they're...
Well, that was one particular station that I saw where what they were doing was being security and also handing out water to people who had been in line, you know, for hours. I will say this, the military needs to be self-sufficient in these situations, mm-hmm. or else they, if they can't provide aid for themselves, they can't aid everybody else. And I think one of the challenges here for the Coast Guard, for the other military branches, was actually having enough fuel supplies for themselves before they could go out and send their people there. So if they're trying to fuel up because they're trying to get trucks into the interior of the country, you would think they would be able to have their own supply source elsewhere.
But there's also plenty of fuel at the port, so the idea that they would have to go to a gas station is kind of bizarre.
It is.
But everything about Puerto Rico appears to be bizarre right
Gabriel,
now.
How's the family doing? Do they have supplies?
Well, they have food and water, you know, thank God. The only thing that they're missing is the gasoline supply to be able to get around to get more food and water if they need to travel throughout the island or help other family members.
Gabriel, we appreciate it. Thanks so much. I want to squeeze in one more call here. Walter in Hallandale Beach. Walter, you are on the Florida Roundup. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you for taking the call. You know, I'm totally disenchanted with the fact of what's going on in Puerto Rico. If you'd go as far back, and I'm going to make this quick, as far back as even World War II or in Vietnam, you would have totally bombed out, totally destroyed airstrips. The Navy CBs were in there, and in 48 hours, you would have functioning airstrips. Now, to get, I don't want to hear that the military can't get the stuff in there. The White House was just reacted way too slow. These things could have been accomplished, got the CBs in there, and we would have had at least some sort of infrastructure to get the trucks moving. And CB drivers could drive any truck that's there. And another thing, I'm totally disenchanted is with the fact that we, hey, Texas has been forgotten about, but the United States Virgin Islands were a total disaster. This all goes back to the White House and silly tweets about things that really are not relevant to people's welfare, right. American citizens.
Walter, we got it. Tim Padgett has some thoughts on your comments. Walter, yeah, thanks for joining us.
Walter makes a really good point. Back in those days, perhaps, there was a lot less dysfunction, I think, between the United States and its Commonwealth in the Caribbean, Puerto Rico. But today, the natural state of things between Washington and the government in San Juan is just utter dysfunction. And we're seeing that play out now in this disaster. And that dysfunction, whether it's just Washington's utter neglect of the island in this century particularly, or the awful bankruptcy that the island has been going through, all of those factors simply made this island far more vulnerable to this storm than it ever should have been. And that's what we're dealing with now.
And vulnerable, Mark Caputo, maybe because of the politics here to some degree.
Well, you might have that. You have the governor of Puerto Rico might not want to have the full military takeover because then he looks like a totally useless governor. Mm-hmm. So that might be a reason he hasn't requested full, utter, you know, total military control.
And also remember, there is a very fraught history recently in this century between Puerto Rico and the U.S. military. If you go out to Vieques, for example, mm-hmm. the controversies over the naval bombing test out there that rendered a lot of people with a lot of illnesses. So it's not politically popular for a Puerto Rico governor to just throw himself into the lap of the U.S. military,
and then,
unfortunately.
And then there's another aspect of it. The San Juan's mayor, who's garnered a lot of attention.
Wants to be governor.
She might run against him.
Right.
And then on top of that, let's move over to the mainland a little more. I mean, we're looking at maybe a million, maybe more people from Puerto Rico coming to the mainland. A lot of them are going to come to Florida. I mean, a heck of a lot of them are going to go to Central Florida. A lot of them, a lot of Puerto Rican people have a tendency to vote Democrat when they vote. They're not the most, let's say, reliable or prolific of voters. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if we wind up with 200,000 more Puerto Rican voters, that's enough to swing an election. The past four top-of-the-ticket races in Florida have been decided by less than 1.5 percentage points, or fewer than 1.5 percentage points. You know, 200,000 more Democratic-leaning voters certainly changes the math majorly. So it's kind of in Trump's interest to make sure a lot of these Democrats don't wind up coming over here and voting.
And, Patty, it's part geography, part civics lessons here, is these folks can vote the minute they get to wherever they're coming to.
Right. So the politics on the island are not dominated by the usual Democrat-Republican. They're dominated by pro-statehood, pro-commonwealth, pro-independence. And that changes the dynamics a little bit, because who do you blame, you know, when the big question is independence or not? So, yeah, once they get on the island, they tend to vote blue. And that's just a political reality. Once they get off on the mainland, I'm sorry, they tend to vote blue.
Let's stay in the Caribbean here today. This morning, the Associated Press reporting that the United States will remove more than half its diplomats and embassy staff from Havana. The AP also reporting that the State Department is warning Americans from traveling to Cuba over health worries. And all this follows the mysterious sonic attacks that American diplomats suffered in Cuba earlier this year. Tim, what more do we know about this development here, about the United States essentially removing, 60% of its embassy staff from Havana?
Right. And here's the big change today. In the past few weeks, all we've been hearing from the Trump administration was that these were incidents. They made a big semantic leap today, calling these attacks. Mm. So we're starting to get a sense that the Trump administration does believe, in particular, after this meeting it had with the secretary or the minister of foreign relations from Cuba, who met with Secretary of State Tillerson early this week, they now believe that this was, if not intentional, at least something that was done by agents of the Cuban government to our diplomats in Havana. But they say that's still under investigation. Mm-hmm. But the fact that they're calling these attacks now instead of incidents really raises the stakes.
How significant, Mark, is the message of pulling these embassy folks out, stopping issuing visas in Havana for Cubans to come to the United States, and then issuing this travel warning for Americans going to Cuba?
Well, what's really kind of interesting is that the Trump administration is taking these steps now based on these, as Tim says, we now call attacks. But in June, they announced they were going to come up with all these different rules and regulations to restrict travel to Cuba.
Right.
And they haven't really done those yet.
Right.
So it's just kind of like, it seems like this catch-as-catch-can policy. In the end, our relations with Cuba are probably too strong and too indelible to go away. But, the Trump administration has not been consistent on almost any of its policy, foreign or domestic. So it's difficult to say what's going to happen.
And Patty Mazzei, I think what's not included in this AP report is anything around the Treasury Department, anything around the Commerce Department, all of these rules and regulations that have been put in place economically for that relationship between the United States and Cuba to have been reforged over the past, 18, 24,
right, we're
30
still
months or so.
We're still waiting for the rewrite
those
rules.
Yeah, these are all about travel and visas.
And these are understaffed agencies, because in some cases, certainly in the State Department, they have not filled these jobs. So everything has gone more slowly. And the argument from people who don't want to see travel to Cuba stopped is, well, if travelers haven't been targeted, why are we, warning them against going? And also, it's just hurting Cubans to slow down the visa process, which was already pretty slow.
Pretty slow to begin with. But Tim, we're not seeing the U.S. government, the Trump administration, make any announcements through anonymous sources, at least to the Associated Press, regarding OFAC and the Office of Foreign Relations in terms of financial relationships.
This seems to be just more of a diplomatic protocol move. The Trump administration obviously feels that it discovered something that lends credence to this idea that someone in the Cuban government, whether it was ordered by the Cuban government or whether it was done by some sort of rogue idiot inside, the Cuban government and screwed up terribly, whatever the scenario, they do believe that the Cuban government somehow was responsible for this. And therefore, they have to take some sort of diplomatic protocol step to express their displeasure and see if they can get the ball rolling on getting the Cuban government to own up to this.
Tim Padgett covers the Americas for us here at WLRN. Patty Mazzei watching politics for a part in the Miami Herald. Mark Caputo doing the same for Politico. We've got more to come here on the Roundup, the political fundraising scandal on Miami Beach. That's next when the Roundup continues. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. First, Michael Grieco wanted to become mayor of Miami Beach. He may wind up fighting for his freedom. He dropped out of the Miami Beach Commission re-election race this week, just 6 weeks before Election Day. He cited his many sacrifices he's had to make for his family, clients, health, and law practice in quitting the race. He did not mention that he is a focus of a criminal political fundraising investigation. That probe centers around his relationship with a political action committee called People for Better Leaders. It raised $200,000 from donors who may have included foreign nationals, and it's illegal for foreigners who do not have green cards to make political contributions. This comes as Florida Democrats pick up a surprise special election win with Annette Tadeo, beating former Trump television apprentice and state representative Jose Felix Diaz. Politics, scandal, and a Democratic win here on the Florida Roundup now. Mark Caputo with Politico, Patty Mazzei with the Miami Herald, and Joy Fletches covering Miami Beach politics for the Miami Herald is with us again. Joy, welcome back. How do investigators think this foreign money potentially worked with this Miami Beach race?
Well, they went into this after the Herald had published articles scrutinizing the PAC over ethics rules that are more stringent in Miami Beach. It's something that's not uncommon in the county and other parts of the state. But in Miami Beach, they, after a couple of years ago, another scandal with a political committee, made rules saying you cannot, commissioners cannot solicit directly or indirectly for political committees.
Right.
So we started writing articles where we suspected that that was going on, and we started looking into it, asking Michael Grieco about it. That ended up spurring this investigation where investigators, according to our sources, found something unexpected, which is that foreign nationals had moved money through a local realtor and into this PAC, which was tied to Michael Grieco. That was a revelation that happened over the past couple of weeks and kind of set into motion what's happened this week, which is Grieco stepping away from the race.
And what's been the response by the now former candidate Grieco, as well as this potential straw man of some kind?
They both haven't responded to questions that we've been posing to them for the past week.
The role of political action committees, you referred to this, Joey, a little bit, and the ethical ordinances that have been passed by the Beach Commission in the past. Are these being put to test right now with this?
Well, they it's interesting to think about how the ethical ordinance, the ethics ordinance, actually led to this other issue, which is a criminal investigation now. There could be a criminal penalty. The ethics ordinance, I've heard through the grapevine, through different sources, that people disagree with them. They think it wouldn't hold up in court. Being able to prohibit the political free speech as campaign donations are usually characterized, that would actually not hold up. But in this case, it's just, you know, I think it's an interesting, you know, line of questioning that led to where we are right now.
Where we are right now. Talk to us about the amount of money involved. This political action committee called People for Better Leaders, about $200,000 for what initially was a Miami Beach mayoral race.
That's right. Michael Grieco started as, he started as a commission candidate last year. There had been rumors around town that he had always had his eyes on the mayor's seat, and many people, many commissioners have been rumored to have their eyes on the mayor's seat. It's a sexy seat for some reason politically. when he entered the mayor's race in January, he was up against Dan Gelber, and this money, this is when the money started to get noticed, and this PAC started to get noticed, and we started looking into it. And then from there, he went into what was a contentious race. After those stories, he ended up backing out from the mayor's race first to go over for his commission seat again for re-election. And then on Monday, he stepped away from that.
Stepped away entirely. Democrats, meantime, regaining one seat in the Florida legislature. Annette Tadeo beating Representative Jose Felix Diaz in the special election for District 40. Patty, how surprising was this win?
Well, the Democrats had felt better about things after their early voting numbers from the weekend, when especially souls to the polls, you know, folks from church going to vote. The hurricane really dampened their door-knocking efforts, not just for them, for both sides, and that's had been one of their chief concerns, and also the fact that the Republicans had really raised more money. So they took it as, you know, we came from behind and took it, despite having been outspent and outraised. And for the Democrats in Florida who don't have many wins at the Tallahassee level, that was a big victory.
So is there a lesson for 2018 as we gear up?
Well, there's a lesson that Democrats can actually win the big
and
one.
And by we, that's I mean the state of Florida. That's what I'm talking about there.
Oh, God, no. Who knows? Every election here, it's just impossible to predict what's going to happen even after it happens. So I do think the takeaway here is that Democrats can actually compete when they're in a district that's winnable. We haven't always seen that.
Mark Caputo, writing about politics in the state of Florida, always a target-rich environment for Politico. Mark, great to have you back on the roundup. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Patty Mazzei, watching politics for a part in the Miami Herald. Patty, welcome back. Really wonderful coverage in San Juan and Puerto Rico. Thanks so much for sharing it with us.
Thanks a lot.
Joy Fletcher, congratulations on wonderful investigations as well, Miami Beach politics. Thanks for joining us on the roundup again.
Thanks for having me.
Finally on the roundup this week, two closings coming up. First, Giancarlo Stanton is closing in on the pre-steroid era home run record. He hit 58 and 59 on Thursday against the Atlanta Braves. He has three more games to hit two more home runs. That would match Roger Maris's 61. And then a day after the Marlins season ends, a new era will begin. Gulf Coast investor Bruce Sherman and former New York Yankee Derek Jeter will officially be the new owners of the Miami Marlins on Monday. Soon-to-be former owner Jeffrey Loria bought the team 15 seasons ago for less than $200 million. He's selling for $1.2 billion, a 650% return, just over Derek Jeter's winning percentage as a player.
Derek Jeter, Derek Jeter.
That'll do it for the Florida Roundup this week. It is produced by Bridget O'Brien. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Teresa Frontato, our digital director. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. Peter J. Meritz, our program director. And our technical supervisor is Jason Zadka. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling and listening.
Derek Jeter, the shortstop, I'm so sweet.